supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and it is June, the time of weddings, and we will celebrate that by helping a bride who's going to get married at the end of the summer grow her own flowers in the question of the week. Mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Margaret, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello,
nice
Margaret.
Nice to meet you.
It's nice to have you here, Margaret. Where are you?
Orlando, Florida.
Oh, well, I guess I shouldn't make any Disney references. That must get really old for... It's like the place didn't even exist before Disney World opened up, right?
I know. It does now, and there's a lot of people here.
Yes. No, it's a very... Well, I mean, Disney picked it, as you probably know, because it is one of the locations in the country that has the nicest weather. I think very specifically, you know, warm weather in the wintertime, but the fewest days of rain, which when you have what was originally like a totally outdoor theme park, was very important.
Not that way anymore.
Do you get a lot of rain?
Well, we get a lot of rain, but we get a lot of very hot days, and it's just so hot here, which is the reason why I was calling you, is because I think there needs to be a new set of temperatures for the country, because the temperatures for planting are usually 1 through 10, right?
Right.
And it needs to go to like 12 now, and that's what we are.
Right. You think you're dialed up to 11, like on Spinal
yeah.
Tap.
Right, yeah. Right. And so what I've been doing, because my vegetable gardening is only about 2 years old,
right,
but doing very well, and I'm learning a lot from your show and from the website, which I really appreciate. But I've set up this system of umbrellas in my backyard, and every day at about 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock, it's just too hot for the plants, and I put up the umbrellas. So my question was, you know, should I be worried about that, or, you know, should I let them have the sun all day long and not worry about the temperature so much and just give them more water?
You are an unusual caller, Margaret, in that you're doing exactly the right thing.
Ooh,
and
wow.
You're doing what the professionals do. You know, as you get further south, it gets hotter and more humid in the summertime. And as you go towards the west, there's Arizona where people hide in caves all summer long.
Yeah, you know. Right. So good. So it's a good idea. And actually, professional people put up umbrellas?
No, they put up what's called shade cloth. For the real professionals, there are different grades of shade cloth. You know, some lighter ones that let in most of the sun, and some that are almost dark as night. And
is there some cloth like that you can leave up all the time that allows the sun that creates chlorophyll and so forth to get through, but not the burning kind of sun that might harm them?
I believe that if you were to go online and look at professional greenhouse suppliers, certainly. Maybe some of the bigger seed catalog companies, they have, you know, home versions of the game, so to speak. And yes, you could rig up shade cloth that, especially as you progress into the heat of your summer, could be up 24/7. You wouldn't need to be out there opening and closing umbrellas.
But
for now, your reactions are absolutely perfect. A lot of people who live in climates like yours year-round have learned to treat July and August as if it were winter. You know, they start their tomato plants in the fall, grow them all winter long, maybe with some, you know, plastic for protection, And, you know, they huge harvests in like March and April when most of us are still dreaming of, is it safe to take our plants outside?
Right.
And then in July and August, they may even just stretch clear plastic over the beds to bake out the root knot nematodes and the diseases you have and then start fresh in the fall. Because in truth, your July and August is a lot like my January and February. You know, just in reverse. It's just too extreme to do anything.
Extreme, right.
So I think you're doing the right thing with the umbrellas, and if it's getting tiresome, that's what you want to search out on the internet. You want to search out shade cloth, and then you want to see if there are ones that are designed for home gardeners that are easy to string up and easy to use.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. I enjoyed the show so much.
Well, thank you, Margaret. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good, Michael. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic.
And where is Michael fantastic?
Folsom, PA.
And where is that?
That is right outside the airport in Delaware County. It's
okay.
Right by Media, PA.
So what can we do for Michael in Folsom?
I actually read your book on compost, and I was reading the chapter on manure, and I have a Peking duck, and I was wondering if I can use her poo for compost.
Oh my God, Peking duck is one of my favorite foods. All the thoughts that are going through my head are inappropriate right now.
Don't tell that to my girlfriend; she'll kill you.
So if you see me coming towards your house with pancakes and hoisin sauce, I won't be welcome, huh?
No, sir.
So you have a pet duck.
Yes, sir.
And is the duck house trained? Does it have its own bathtub or something? I mean,
we keep her in a little kennel at night, and I have a little duck coop during the day outside.
But don't they like to be in water all the time? Does she have a little kiddie pool to?
She does. She has a kiddie pool. They're very clean animals. They swim all day.
Back in the 90s, when I was the editor-in-chief of Organic Gardening magazine, we did 5 major exhibits at the Philadelphia Flower Show. And one of the most popular was a victory garden that went from the farm to the city. A big exhibit, biggest landscaping exhibit we ever did, biggest footprint. And in the farm section, we had chickens, ducks, and geese. And the ducks were just delightful. We built this pool for them, and they were gregarious. They were real crowd pleasers. They loved people coming around. They loved being in that water. And as you say, they were remarkably clean.
Yeah, actually, when I'm gardening, she follows me around eating Japanese beetles for me.
Excellent, excellent. I rent that duck out.
Yes, sir.
So you're asking about duck poop.
Yes, sir.
And how do you, I don't want to be indelicate, how do you collect this? What form is it in? Does she poop in her pool, or?
It's kind of wherever, but most of the time, at night we have her in a sort of kennel, and she has towels, and the poop resembles goose poop.
Right.
So it's almost like small dog waste.
Did you ever consider putting some sort of bedding in the kennel instead, something like shredded leaves or wood shavings or something like that?
Well, it's really my girlfriend's duck, and she's had it her entire life, and she had originally had hay down.
Right.
And the hay gave her some abscesses on her feet, so she can't sleep in it. I believe she can. She can walk through it, but she can't sleep through it all night.
Oh, okay,
so
okay.
Outside in her pen, I'd be willing to throw some hay down, and that's why I was, why I'm calling in. I was considering throwing straw outside, not hay, outside, collecting it that way and using it as manure compost.
However you can harvest it, just mix it with dry brown material, shredded leaves, straw, as you say, if I said hay, I didn't mean to say hay. Straw, certainly, with no seed heads. Do you have an active compost pile?
Yes, sir.
I would just mix it in, And, you know, animal manures like this are said to make the absolute finest compost. They will heat up your compost pile. They will make the compost faster, and the finished compost will be of higher quality. And then I presume when you change her water, do you try to pour that water out onto the garden?
Oh, I don't. I never actually thought of that. No. I actually created a natural filter. I filter the water back in.
Oh, okay. If it was just a case of you having a little pool that you emptied out once a week, I would bucket that water out, and I would certainly use it to water the base of my plants during dry times. But if you're filtering it, that's great. And what's the duck's name? We've been impolite here.
Her name is Dermish.
Dermish?
My girlfriend tells me it's something from Scottish folklore. I don't know. She named it.
A whirling dermish, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah, but just mix it into your compost pile, and it will only make your compost that much better.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Say hello to Dermish for us.
I will.
All right. You take care, sir.
You too. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who got their peas in on time to be looking for those first delicious little pods anytime now. Of course, English shelling peas should be left on the vine until the tasty peas are fairly big inside of those pods. But eating pod and all types, like snap and snow peas, taste best when they're picked very small. Just don't go looking for all the details under P for Peas in the A to Z Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how an August bride can grow her own bridal bouquet. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Bridal Garden.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we know there's a lot of June brides getting ready right now. Well, we have a bride getting married in August who insists that she is capable of growing her own wedding flowers. So we're going to give her some sage advice that will not involve growing sage in any way, shape, or form. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Adam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Adam. How are you, sir?
Doing wonderful. Calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Very good, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
I've got a question for you about an azalea. Moved to this house a few years ago from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, actually, where I've had the honor to hear you speak a couple of times, as a matter of fact.
Oh, excellent.
So I have this azalea that gets full sun all day long, and it's about a foot away from my foundation and about 8 inches away from a brick walkway, and it's not looking very good. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to move it into a shade garden that I'm creating on the other side of my house. And I was wondering if you had any tips about when to move it or how to move it. You know, I don't really care if it blooms next year or not, but I would like the poor thing to live.
Now, when you say it's not doing well, do you think that's because it's getting too much sun, it's around too much concrete, or is it possible that it just hasn't been cared for?
Probably too close to the brick and probably too much sun. I do care for it very well.
Oh, okay.
I give it a peat moss dressing and, you know, give it a little bit of watered-down coffee water every once in a while and mulch it with my own compost.
Okay.
So I'm really thinking that it's a sun-brick issue.
So you're doing exactly the same thing that I do for my azaleas, which is every once in a while when I don't drink a pot of coffee, I go toss it on them. I make sure they have a nice mulch of peat moss covered by compost. And in the wild, azaleas and other members of the rhododendron family are traditionally understory plants in deciduous forests, which means they get sun over the winter and the spring and fall, but they get shielded in the real dog days of summer. So here's the deal. Your timing is perfect, man, because I presume, well, it should be blooming or finishing blooming. Where are you with it?
I would say that it's about two-thirds of the way done blooming.
Okay.
There are some top areas that haven't bloomed yet, but they're losing their leaves quicker than I'm losing my hair. And
really?
That says something.
Yeah,
yeah.
And what color are the leaves?
The leaves themselves, the edges of them are like a burnt brown.
Hmm.
Some of the new little shoots that are coming out of the trunk are, you know, kind of like a greenish yellow. It's not looking all that great.
So it does. It sounds like it's a difficult site to keep acidified correctly.
I would say it's close to impossible, to be honest with you.
Okay. So we should let it finish blooming. This is the natural cycle. But then the good news is that after azaleas and rhododendrons are done blooming, they really like to be pruned back. And it is the time of year when pruning back not only doesn't harm them, but stimulates a lot of new growth for the following season without interfering with flowering. So you can certainly reduce the size of the plant after it's done flowering by at least a third.
See, that would be great. That would take off all that. I mean, it looks fairly full at the bottom, but getting rid of that top, you know, third of it would really, I think, make it look more like a healthy plant.
Now, the one thing you have to be careful about, and the one thing most people don't realize, azaleas and other members of the rhododendron family have very shallow, delicate roots, very sensitive roots. So when you dig this puppy out of the ground, you want to start at least a foot away from the trunk, maybe a foot and a half, get a bunch of guys with shovels to kind of surround it, to keep putting the shovels into the ground. And ideally, you want to bring up an island of soil. You want to try not to just bring up the bare roots. You want to try to move an island of soil. And you want,
like, how deep down do you think that I should be?
As far as you, if you can get four guys with shovels and a tarp, go down until it starts to feel warm and you hear the screams of the souls of the damned. I mean, you can't go too deep. What I want you to do is hydrate the plant first. Do this after a rain or soak it the day before. And I want you to move it in the evening around 5 o'clock at night, not first thing in the morning. When you get the island of soil out of the ground, try to even use the shovels to transport it to the tarp. Lay it on the tarp and then carry the tarp to the new planting site. Don't dig too deep a hole. Just dig a deep enough hole to accommodate your island of soil. And then any extra area in the hole, just go crazy with milled peat moss.
And in the hole that I'll be transplanting it to,
yes,
correct?
This is the only time that I recommend, actually, this and blueberries is the only time I ever recommend amending the soil in the hole. And that's just with pure peat moss, because we really want to give this creature the acid soil that it requires. When you drop the new plant in, do the same thing, mulch it with peat moss, cover it with a little bit of compost, and then the most important thing, you want to leave a hose dripping at the base of that plant for at least 24 hours. And I mean, just okay. like the kind of drip that drives you crazy in like a sink, a very slow
sure,
drip.
Sure.
But you really want to saturate that soil. And all summer long, I want you to pay attention. Anytime we go, I would normally say a week without rain, but in this case, any 4 days without rain, any heat waves, do the same thing. That's the first okay. plant I want you to give the hose to. Make sure it doesn't go without water over the course of the summer. And I think if you can do all that, you're going to see success right away. Moving in the evening is also going to be key. I don't want you to move it and plant it first thing in the morning and then it get any sun at all.
Okay. Now, the area that I would like to move it to, it's I would say that it's about 7 feet away from the trunk of another tree. Is that going to be okay?
That's fine.
Okay, cool. Very good. And mulch it with, like, shredded leaves or pine straw or something along those lines?
Peat moss and compost.
Okay. Now, do you think that this azalea that I'll be moving will flower next year?
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's great. Awesome.
If you do it right after blooming, you cut it back like I said, you move it as carefully as I said, you do it right away in the evening, keep it well watered. There's no reason it shouldn't.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your help, Mike. I really appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Adam.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Thomas, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine today, sir. How are you?
Good. Hey, I had a question about coffee grounds. I wanted to know the best way to utilize them.
And where are you, sir?
I'm in Tennessee, Knoxville, Tennessee.
Oh, okay. Very good. And how many coffee grounds do you generate?
Really not a whole lot. Probably maybe a cup to 2 cups a week.
What kind of plantings do you have?
We have some fresh herbs, and a lot of times I'll just sprinkle it in the yard or put it around some of the trees.
Yeah, but what kind of plants do you have outside? What do you grow in the summer? Do you have, for instance, do you have any acid-loving plants like blueberries, azaleas, rhododendrons, camellias?
Yeah, definitely. Yep, rhododendrons and azaleas for sure. Yes.
Okay. So what you want to do, if you want the and do you make compost over the winter or anything like that?
I do not, no.
Okay. If you made compost, I would tell you that shredding up your fall leaves and mixing them with your coffee grounds makes the world's greatest compost. But you have to be careful using coffee grounds straight on plants because they're all nitrogen. And nitrogen is a good plant food to help plants grow bigger, but it can inhibit flowering. Coffee grounds are also highly acidic, so you only want to put them on plants that like an acid soil. So you have to balance that, the need for the acid soil, with not impairing the flowering of the plant. For instance, I put straight coffee grounds on my azaleas and rhododendrons in the early spring, when you can see that the flower buds are already formed. So it's not going to inhibit their flowering, but the plants are beginning to grow again. So, and I will save up my coffee grounds. They store very easily. Just leave the container open until they dry out a little bit. And then in the spring, when everything starts growing, you can put coffee grounds around your azaleas, your blueberries, your rhododendrons, your camellias, the more the better. If, for instance, your azaleas and rhododendrons ever look a little yellow, that's a lack of acid in the soil, and they love coffee grounds. And quite honestly, with the small amount of coffee you're drinking and the small amount of grounds, I don't think you're going to inhibit flowering. So I'm just going to say, as you generate the grounds, you can spread them around the base of the acid-loving plants, azaleas, rhododendrons, blueberries, camellias, especially if it's just like, 2 cups worth a week, just go from plant to plant every week, give a different plant a couple of coffee grounds around the base. They'll absolutely love it. It'll keep the soil a little bit acidic and it'll give them a little bit of natural plant food. But don't put the coffee grounds on plants that want a neutral soil, like your house plants right. or the herbs.
Okay, wonderful. Great.
All right, Tom?
I'll do that. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. You take care. You have a good season.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Fran, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you,
Thanks
Fran.
Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thank you for making it. Where are you?
I'm in Southport, North Carolina.
Okay. Where is Southport?
It's on the southeastern coast. I'm on the Intercoastal Waterway, the ocean, and the Cape Fear River. It's pretty far, about far south as you can go in North Carolina.
Oh, okay. So you're right at the border of the warring states there. And it sounds like you're surrounded by water.
Yeah, there's a lot of water here. It's lovely.
Oh, man. That would spoil me to death.
I just moved here from Northern Virginia, so gardening here is a little different.
Yeah, when you say Northern Virginia, I think of the D.C. area.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's where I was, and we had definite seasons there, and long, hot summer. And I've got some tomatoes in an earth box.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how a grafted tomato is going to do in that.
Okay. Earth boxes are relatively small growing areas that are designed to be self-watering. I'm not the biggest fan of them. I don't like self-watering containers. I found that they keep plants too wet and they can contribute to disease. But one thing you really have to be careful about is because there's that active water reservoir there all the time, you have to treat the water with BTI to make sure mosquitoes don't breed in it.
Correct.
Otherwise, you've got this stagnant water source there constantly. So you have an earth box that you want to grow tomatoes in, or you already are?
I've already planted them, but one of them is a grafted tomato, an heirloom, a Cherokee. And
right,
I've never grown a grafted tomato before, and I'm wondering, since the grow box, earth box, you know, you have a cover on it and the foils, I'm wondering if my graft is going to remain high enough above the soil that I won't get a problem with tomatoes that I don't want.
If you had talked to me in the past, I would have advised you to stay with smaller tomato plants. Shorter season tomatoes so that, you'd get a lot of tomatoes before that summer heat hit you. Also, plants that are determinate, that only grow to about 4 or 5 feet long and then stop. Cherokee
right.
Purple is a legendary heirloom, and you can grow it. You have a long growing season down in North Carolina. But what are you going to do with a vine that, if the plant is healthy, is going to be 12 foot long at the end of the growing season?
Well, that will be a problem. I have bamboo supports, but they're not 12 feet. They're about 7, I guess. So maybe that won't be sufficient.
So be aware that when you're growing these big heirlooms, that they generally need to be grown. And there's no reason you couldn't rig up a cage outside the earth box to contain the growing tomato and using up a lot of lateral space. But I have to warn you that, these heirloom varieties, Cherokee Purple is one of the best tasting varieties, one of the most colorful, but all of these older heirlooms produce late in the season and they have 10 to 12 foot, sometimes even 14 foot long vines. And if you just keep cutting the plant back, you greatly limit or maybe even don't get any tomatoes. Now, grafted tomatoes typically use a rootstock that is disease resistant or that has some sort of special ability. Grafted tomatoes are the variety you want to grow, grafted onto the rootstock of a different tomato that was not a good eating tomato, but it was very disease resistant or vigorous or had some other attribute. Do you know what your rootstock is supposed to be doing for you?
Exactly what you said. I thought it gives it a more healthy, stronger structure. But I didn't know that it was not generally a good eating tomato, that it was grafted onto. I had roses, and I've had problems with grafted roses.
Right, because if the top rose dies, you can get a really crappy rose off of the rootstock.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
So what you want to do is the same thing, the same principle applies, whether it's a grafted fruit tree, a grafted rose, a grafted tomato, the graft must remain well above the soil line. So as long as you can always see the graft, and you might want to rig up some little thing to support it to make sure that it doesn't turn sideways and start landing on the soil.
Right. Okay.
But as long as that graft stays above the soil line, you will only grow a Cherokee purple. If you were to make a very reasonable mistake and bury the stem deeply, as we often advise for regular tomatoes, then the rootstock would take over, and you would get what, by all accounts, is a miserable tomato. So you really want to keep that rootstock above ground, and think of support. You know, if you have a deck, for instance, that's like on a second floor, let the tomato vine trail over the deck and head down towards the ground. Then you can really achieve the full length of this fabulous heirloom and allow the tomato to do what it would naturally, but keep it in the air with full air circulation and no ground contact.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Well, thank you very much for the information. I appreciate it.
All right. Stay cool, Fran.
I will.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a very special talk on the best ways to turn your yard and garden waste and all those stinky scraps from your kitchen into great garden gold at the Burlington County Earth Fair in historic Smithville Park on Sunday, June 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow your own wedding flower bouquet. I'm bouquetish Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a couple of minutes, we'll get to the question of the week, celebrating the month of June, the month of weddings, by helping an August bride grow her own bridal bouquet for a late August wedding this year. It's so romantic, and we'll get to it right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Mike. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate you being here. Where are you, man?
I'm currently driving somewhere around Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And where is your gardening question related to?
I live in New Albany, Ohio, outside of Columbus.
All right. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I moved into a new house in August last year. Beautiful property, and it's got some existing apple and pear trees.
Oh, God.
And I got a decent crop of apples. They tasted delicious. They weren't real big. But we had a drought, so I don't think they were really attended to throughout the summer. Pear trees didn't really have anything on them to speak of. And I want to have a plan this year as far as dealing with, bugs and pests. And I've been doing a little research on kind of homemade pesticides so I don't have to go the chemical route. So I want to ask you if you have, some experience with homemade pesticides. And if you think there's a good one out there, also, when is the best time to apply it?
How many apple trees do you have?
I have four.
We need to go back. Do you remember when the apples blossomed, how beautiful they were?
Well, I just saw that, so for the first time at my new place.
Okay, because you should have been ready to prune them right around that time. The reason you got tiny apples wasn't because of summer. Summer is finally when you really get to relax with these things. The work involved with apple trees and peach trees is pruning out branches for improved airflow. And then once those flowers begin setting those little fruits, they must be thinned massively. Fruit trees are very time consuming. I'm presuming that you have little apples forming all over your trees right now. It's getting late to prune them, but I think it's better to prune them than not. You need to take out some of the crossing branches, open up the center of the plants to get more airflow. But then the really tedious task is you need to remove 3/4 of the apples from the trees like now. And that will give the tree enough energy to produce the full-size apples that you're interested in. The size issues you had were lack of pruning and fruit thinning, not any kind of pest problem.
Yeah, the trees don't look like they've been pruned for a few years, which was kind of another thing that I wanted to ask about is the pear trees they're too tall. If they actually had a fruit at the top, there'd be no way to get it.
Right.
And so they kind of need some dramatic pruning, but I didn't want to do anything that might be too dramatic and that would damage the trees.
Well, the worst thing you could do is timing to prune them in the summer or the fall. So like I said, we're kind of getting out of the season of safe pruning now. 2 or 3 weeks ago even would have been much better. The first chance you get, I would go in there, I would get a good set of pruning tools right away and take out just some branches, some of the ones that seem overly full that are in the center of the plant, and then read up on fruit tree pruning and be ready next winter or this coming winter and early spring. You can do your pruning anytime from the dormant season, midwinter, through when the plants are actively flowering. So you can stretch it out. It doesn't have to be all at once. And then the pears, after just pruning the pears should really revitalize them. They generally don't need a lot of care. They don't need thinning, and they don't need a lot of pest protection. The homemade pesticides is crazy talk. You don't want to go there. You don't want to start mixing up junk in your sink based on something on the internet. Now, in your area of the country, there are a number of insect pests and diseases that attack apples. The one, quote, pesticide I would recommend for someone who doesn't yet know what their problems are, over the next couple of years, you'll find what kind of pests are attacking the apples and what kind of diseases. There is a product called Surround, S-U-R-R-O-U-N-D. It is a micronized clay, totally non-toxic, but you couldn't make it at home. It's a powdered form of clay, and you'll need a good sprayer. My friend Lee Reich and I both grow a lot of fruits organically, and this is the only control we use after years and years of trying lots of things. Once the apples are about half-sized, you spray them with this clay spray, and it's weird. It turns everything light gray. But the plant still photosynthesizes. It improves their size and their taste and their flavor. The little bit of clay on the surface of the fruit keeps pests and disease off. They can't penetrate the clay layer. And, of course, it's just a little spray of clay. So at harvest time, you can just wash it right off, and there's no residue, there's no taste, there's no odor. And it really is a godsend for people who want to grow fruits without really toxic pesticides. And in your case, it's a double godsend because you don't have to know what your troubles are.
That sounds perfect for me.
Yeah, you spray the clay on the trees a couple of times over the course of the growing season. You may never find out what your problems would have been.
Okay, that's great. Very helpful.
All right, Mike?
Yeah, I'm going to get home and start pruning.
And then also, I want you to go to our website. I want you to go to You Bet Your Garden. I want you to go to click on Garden Answers A to Z and read the articles under F for fruit trees. It'll give you a little treatise on how to care for them and how to prune them.
That sounds great. I'll do that. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you.
Well, thank you, John. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you today?
I am just fine. Thanks. Where is John doing good?
I'm in Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey.
What can we do for John in Egg Harbor?
Well, I got a property out here. I have about 5 acres. Probably 3 of it is cleared. And I have a nice bamboo collection and a lot of plantain lilies. But my problem is I'm infested with moles and voles. And about half of my plantains came up this year. And my bamboo patches are really big, so they're not completely destroying it, but I can see the effects of it. And I've tried poison traps, and I haven't been real successful with it.
Okay, well, poison doesn't work. Poison doesn't work on either creature because of what they eat. Moles only eat live food. So they're not going to take juicy fruit gum or poison gummy worms. They only eat earthworms, beetle grubs, and cicada larvae. And
okay.
Voles only eat underground plant roots. So unless you are going to inject a plant with somehow systemic cyanide, you'd never get it to them. But what you can do by applying poison is you can wipe out the predators in the area that would otherwise keep these creatures under control. Every time somebody spreads poison to stop vermin like this, they wind up accidentally killing a couple of foxes, weasels, owls, raptors, all these creatures that would have eaten enormous numbers of your pests. So
wow.
No more of that. I want you to make a 180-degree turn, and I want you to put up raptor perches, crossbeams, simple crossbeams, about 4 foot wide, about 6 feet off the ground. You can go online. Maybe go to the National Wildlife Federation or some other places and find out the exact kind of construction. But dirt simple, you want to set up perches so that hawks and owls will visit your property and will use these perches. You will be amazed. I actually wiped out the vole population at our church's graveyard by simply getting them to bring out the crucifixes from Lent and set them up. And nobody ever saw the owls, but we saw the pellets underneath the perches all the time.
Right.
The other thing you can do, and I'm not sure how effective this is going to be over a large area because it's going to get expensive, is there are castor oil products, concentrated castor oil, that impart a very strong smell, a very strong odor to the ground. And they're available in both liquid and granular form. Obviously, you'd have to buy them in bulk, but I would recommend you treat the worst infested areas with castor oil. This won't kill the moles or voles. It will only drive them further out, further away from your desired plantings. And then the way to trap voles, V-O-L-E-S, the ones who are actually eating your plants, is with simple mouse traps. Believe it or not, I think the raptor perches are going to be your biggest success here. And
well, that sounds great. I've been listening to your show a long time. I was really skeptical that you would have anything new for me that I haven't already tried, but right. I'm really glad that you do, and I'm very optimistic about giving that a try.
All right. Good luck, John.
Hey, thanks again.
My pleasure. Take care.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Growing your own flowers for an August wedding. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, read this week's oh-so-romantic question.
Absolutely. We heard from Julia in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, who writes, I'm getting married on August 24th and would like to grow some of my own flowers for the wedding. What can I plant over the next few weeks that would bloom abundantly in late August? Specifically, I'd like plants with sturdy stems that will hold up in arrangements and bouquets. I'd also welcome any suggestions in terms of staggering plants to make sure we have something to cut that week. At the very least, I would like to have flowers blooming at our house, as we'll have lots of people coming through. Now, I acknowledge that female wedding hysteria is a real risk, but I have a vegetable garden, grew up gardening with my parents and grandparents, my fiancé and I are avid do-it-yourselfers, we'll have help from friends and family, and this is the only major project I plan to personally undertake.
Well, it sounds like Julia has already heard my standard, what, are you crazy, response when brides-to-be have called into the show with similar questions, as she tries to make a case that she can handle growing her own flowers at a time when many rational, highly talented, multitasking-capable women have been known to misplace their head. I asked the highly talented professional flower grower Melanie DeVault of Pheasant Hill Farm in Veracruz, Pennsylvania, if she agreed, and she told me to stop being such a cranky old man. I think it's a sweet idea, she countered. And she adds, it's a lot easier to do for an August wedding than one in June. August is when a lot of easy-to-grow, long-stemmed cutting flowers are hitting their peak bloom. Zinnias and ornamental sunflowers are the easiest, says Mel. Those are the colorful, smaller sunflowers designed for cutting, not the giant birdseed-producing monsters. Just direct seed them now and they should do fine. Any idiot can grow them, she said, looking distinctly in my direction. And yes, I would advise succession planting, she continues, especially for the sunflowers. I'd sow three runs, each about 2 weeks apart. That way you'll be sure to have some nice-looking ones. And grow the newer pollen-free varieties that don't shed their pollen all over the place after they're cut. Now, bridal bouquets have two components, she continues, focal flowers and filler flowers. For the focal point, I like sunflowers, the daisy-like flowers of Rebecca, and dahlias, especially the variety Karma. That's what I used in my daughter's bridal bouquet. Some roses can also look nice. I use bits of ageratum, baby's breath, and celosia for the filler flowers that make the bouquet look nice and full. There's also a tall cutting form of ageratum called Blue Horizon that looks really good in bouquets. Plant the sunflowers close together, about 4 to 6 inches apart, advises Melanie, to get smaller blooms. Cut the zinnias when the stem is sturdy and just a little pollen is showing. And look around at what's blooming in nature around that time. Queen Anne's lace, for instance, is really nice in arrangements. And no matter what flowers you choose, present them well. Removing every bad leaf really makes a difference in the presentation. But growing flowers and knowing exactly when to cut them isn't as easy as it looks, warns this voice of experience, who also advises reading Lynn Bezinski's book, The Flower Farmer, for some more solid functional advice. Melanie adds that Lynn is currently working on a book specifically about wedding flowers that future brides-to-be might want to keep in mind. Now, for bedding plants in the wedding area, I'm going to suggest my favorite easy-to-grow annuals, begonias for somewhat shady areas and marigolds for sun. I especially like the firecracker variety of marigold. It's incredibly colorful, and it's one of the first plants I grew for my wife, who is still married to me 32 years later, so it can't be that bad. Melanie adds Solania begonias to the bedding plant list, especially the reds and butter yellows, she explains. They grow nicely even in the sun and tend to really blossom well and look gorgeous in late summer. And how about extending the flowering theme to those traditional little takeaway gifts for the guests? It's a perfect time of year for spring bulbs. So how about giving each guest a few bulbs of your favorite spring bloomers, either by type or by color? Instruct the recipients to plant the bulbs in the ground after Halloween, and they'll have a nice reminder of your wedding next spring. Perhaps every spring, if you pick bulbs that have a high rate of survival and return, like daffodils. And come to think of it, the miniature daffodil named Tete-a-Tete would seem an especially appropriate choice here. And the timing is going to be close, but late August is also when nurseries and garden centers begin selling pansies for fall planting. I don't advise trying to grow these cool weather lovers yourself over summer. It's very difficult. But see if a local nursery in your area can have a couple of flats ready for you. Enough to maybe give each guest a little 4 or 6 pack of these very special flowers that survive the coldest winters outside in the ground. Hey, who says I'm not romantic? Well, that was some fine information about growing flowers that are especially festive in August, now wasn't it? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to divorce me if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint. In our Garden Answers A to Z section. It's the thing that says Garden Answers A to Z at the top of the page, honestly. You can also listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is WHYY senior engineer Fred. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Our august editor is Al Banks. Our blushing intern is Jolie Higazi. Happily married, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm smart enough not to say anything here that might aggravate my wife, Mike McGrath, and Al, no! No, that's not wedding music, Al, don't play! Oh well, at least I'll be sure to see you next week, as I believe I'll be sleeping in the studio between now and then. Thanks a lot, Al. Honey, it was Al, it wasn't me. Remember when I grew you marigolds? Honey!
Do you have a grapevine that looks great in the spring but always seems to go bad before harvest time? On the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, host Mike McGrath will reveal how proper pruning, plucking, and picking can produce grapes you'll be proud of. Plus, your fabulous phone calls.